and innovation for engineers and scientists worldwide, MathWorks.com, and by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, supporting trials of potential vaccines to prevent AIDS, GatesFoundation.org. WBUR recognizes the Vietnamese American Civic Association, providing health education, crisis intervention, and employment and training to programs to the Vietnamese community in Boston, VACABoston.org. In the forecast, partly cloudy tonight in the 40s, right now 50 in Boston, 50 in Providence.
Good evening and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Ted O'Brien. Tonight, we'll hear excerpts from the dedication speeches of two major university undertakings. A bit later in the program, we'll hear excerpts from the dedication of the $220 million John Hancock Student Village and the Harry Aganis Arena. But first, the Center for Judaic Studies has been a fixture at Boston University for many years. This year, it was renamed in honor of university professor and Nobel Peace Prize honoree Elie Wiesel. To mark the occasion, one of Israel's foremost writers, Aaron Appelfeld, spoke on literature and the Holocaust. Following Mr. Appelfeld's lecture, we'll hear from Elie Wiesel. Now, to introduce the Appelfeld lecture, here is Boston University Chancellor John Silver.
Aaron Appelfeld was born in 1932 in Chernowitz, a city whose 20th century journey took it from a Habsburg province to north of the interwar Romania, then to the edge of the Soviet Union, and thence to the frontiers of Ukraine. Chernowitz itself, of course, never moved. It remains on the bank of the Prut River, and in the memory of tiny Bukovina, is still capital of a province at the end of neglected roads and worn railway tracks. In Mr. Appelfeld's novel, Tzlili, an escapee from a concentration camp explains to a young girl what the provinces are. "The provinces," he writes, "are places without gymnasiums, without theaters, where people are more fanatical about the German language than in the city." As in many of Mr. Appelfeld's novels, the provinces are also places of slow menace, where the fury of the Holocaust seeps into the peasantry like a brook feeding cattails on its banks. Mr. Appelfeld was deported from Chernowitz to a concentration camp at the age of 8. By the time he was 9, he had escaped and hid for 3 years in the Ukrainian woods before joining the Russian army as a junior cook. After time in an Italian refugee camp, he made his way to Israel. There, in dozens of novels, collections of essays, and memoirs, he has recalled how Eastern European Jews listened as the German language of the Habsburg realm, a language of assimilation, became the horrid language of Nazi terror. Educated in the culture of Vienna, Mr. Appelfeld struggled instead of writing in German, to write in Hebrew, to tell of all he had seen. His mastery of Hebrew ranks as a literary achievement with Joseph Conrad's mastery of English. Appelfeld's stories are as spare as the Torah. At the close of his book, To the Fields of Cattails, he writes, "The end of summer calls down upon the plains its curse of dust. In the cornfields, a young boy wanders, wondering where all the Jews have gone. But rumors only find their reference when an old locomotive, drawing two old cars, appears on the horizon, scrupulously gathering up the remainder." If we can comprehend the fear of wandering in a familiar land, become suddenly and menacingly alien, we owe our understanding to the writings of our guest tonight. If our duty to remember seems as urgent as the need to scour for sausage and bread, we owe that sense of urgency to his spare words. It is a great pleasure and honor to introduce Mr. Aaron Appelfeld, who will speak to us tonight on literature and the Holocaust.
Dear Dr. Silver, dear my friend Professor Elie Wiesel, it's a privilege to lecture on a day when Jewish studies are named Elie Wiesel Jewish Studies, and it's a privilege to be here, ladies and gentlemen. 57 years passed since the end of the Second World War. Now it seems to me we are entering a new period in our relation to the Holocaust. The change is more and more visible because the survivors are departing from the world. The survivors were and remain the dread of everyone who writes about the Holocaust, whether as a historian or as an author. The survivors stood on watch to see that the events were told in the proper order, that places and names were not omitted, that details were not distorted. For the survivor, it was important to have the Holocaust be told with precise detail. I have often been reprimanded by survivors either for imprecision or for describing what happened during or after the Holocaust in a manner critical of the victims. For the survivor, chronological memory was an anchor to which he clung with all his strengths. Imaginative writing on the Holocaust has been regarded and is still in an act incommensurate with the gravity of the subject. You often hear, on the Holocaust, one does not play with words or forms, but rather one tells things as they were, as precisely as possible. The entry of any creative element other than memory into this subject is forbidden. It is no coincidence that most writing about the Holocaust is in the realm of history. Psychology, theology comprise a tiny portion. Very little imaginative writing has been produced about the Holocaust. True, plenty of sensationalist literature on the subject has been written, but literary works containing an inner truth are very uncommon. A child could number them. Memory and commemoration were the power they drove the survivors. The oath to tell everything, not to leave any corner neglected, to surround the horror from all sides, has never been forgotten by the survivor. Now we stand close to the threshold of the period in which the story of the Holocaust will have to stand without survivors. As long as the survivors lived among us, the Holocaust has a most palpable presence. The Holocaust had a given name, family name, town and a village. With his presence, his silence, the survivor gave expression to the horrors. You met him in the street, in his home, at the memorials, actually everywhere. The continued presence of the survivors among us brought the Holocaust out from the unbelievable to that of the visible. If you doubted what harm a person was capable of doing to his fellow, to what depths of barbarity a person could reach, the survivor came and told you. Now the survivors are slowly departing from the world, and a fear is felt, how will the story of the Holocaust be continued without them? In other words, how can we preserve the individuality and the intimacy that the survivor gave to the dreadful experience? No, approaching the front is a different kind of survivor. All those who were children when the war broke out, their memory is a different memory, and their expression of the events is different. All those years, children survivors were not counted as survivors, and their memory has not been regarded as a memory. To understand the character of the child's memory, it's important to understand the nature of the adult survivor's testimony. A rich body of testimony has been written about the Holocaust. When you check the nature of the testimony, you quickly realize that it lacks introspection. Most testimonies are actually chronicles. All that was revealed to the Jew during those years was beyond his reason and his soul. He had been at the very point where the horror took place, and once he was free, he wished to see it as a nightmare, a rift in life that had to be healed as quickly as possible. A horror that does not deserve a spiritual reckoning, only a curse. While the adult survivor recounts and reveals, at the very same time he also conceals. For it is impossible not to tell, and it is also impossible to admit that what happened did not change him. He remained the same person, bound to the same old civil concepts. Holocaust testimony must be read with caution, so that one sees not only what is in it, but also and essentially what is lacking in it. The survivor's testimony is first of all a search for relief. I have done what I'm supposed to do. What transpired between him and the dread horrors during the years of suffering? What changed within him, and what will be his way of life from now on? You will not, it seems to me, find answer to those questions. To avoid misunderstanding, I shall immediately add that the literature of testimony is undoubtedly the authentic literature of the Holocaust. It is an enormous reservoir of Jewish chronology. Now we are coming close to those who were children during the Holocaust, and their testimony is different. The children did not absorb the full horror. Only that portion of it which children could take in. Children lack the sense of chronology, of comparison with the past. While the adult survivor spoke about what had been before the war, for the children, the Holocaust was the present, their childhood and youth. They knew no other childhood or happiness. They grew up in dread. They knew no other life. While the adults fled from themselves and from their memories, repressing them and building up a new life in place of their previous life, the children had no previous life, or if they had, it was no effaced. The Holocaust was the black milk, as the poet said, that they sucked morning, noon, and night. That psychological aspect also had ideological significance. The Holocaust is mostly conceived, even among its victims, as an episode, a madness, an eclipse that does not belong to the normal flow of time, a volcanic eruption of which one must beware, but which indicates nothing about the rest of life. The Holocaust as life in its most dreadfully concentrated form from both the existential and social point of view, that approach was rejected by the victim. The numerous books of testimony that were written about the Holocaust are, if you will, a desperate effort to force the Holocaust into a remote recess of madness, to cut it out from life, and in other cases, to envelop it in a kind of mystical aura, intangible, which must be discussed is a kind of experience that cannot be expressed in words, but rather in prolonged silence. In the case of children who grew up in the Holocaust, life during the Holocaust was something they could understand, for they had absorbed it in their blood. They knew man as a beast of prey, not metaphorically, but as a physical reality with his full stature and clothing, his way of standing and sitting, his way of caressing his own child and of beating a Jewish child. The children would sit for hours and observe. Hunger, thirst, and weakness made them observant creatures. Rather than the murderers, they observed their fathers and elderly brothers in their weakness and in their heroism. Those visions were stamped upon them the way childhood is stamped upon the matrix of one's flesh. The war revealed to us, to our surprise, that even the most dreadful life was nonetheless life. In the ghettos and camps, people loved, sang sentimental songs, and discussed political party programs. Evening courses in German and French were given, and people drank cheap coffee if they had any in the afternoon. On the shroud of death, a man still sewed on his button. The closer death came to us, the greater was our refusal to admit its existence. Everyone held on to his little hopes, mostly trivial matters, such as enjoying a cigarette, for example. I remember a young man who absolutely refused to be deprived of his math textbooks. He solved problems all the time. He did not want to miss out on the second year course. Those strange math exercises done between deportation and deportation made him a tranquil person. In the camps and in the ghettos, people played cards a lot, also dominoes and chess. Sometimes, in the good, forgetful moment, it did not seem like a death ghetto, but rather like a summer camp for overgrown children, deeply engrossed in their play. When the people who were adults during the war came to tell their story, their emphasis was on chronicle, names, places, dates. Their sensation and feelings were formed in general terms, and without introspection. For the child survivors, the war was their full life. They could not speak about the Holocaust in historical, theological, or moral terms. They could speak only about fears, hunger, colors, cellars, woods. People who were good to them or people who treated them badly. The power of their testimony lies in their limited horizon. But through their limited horizon, we learn a lot about cruelty, generosity, hatred, and love. They sucked the war years through their bodies. For them, Holocaust was life, the only life they knew. No wonder that their testimony was rejected by the grown-up survivors. It was seen by them as fantasy, distortion, diminishing the gravity of the subject. And now, when the denial of the Holocaust is growing, you often hear, take out fantasy from the Holocaust testimony. You should cling more and more to the facts. It is difficult for people to accept that every situation, even the most clear-cut, produces different testimonies, not to speak of children's recollections. Now we have a body of testimonies, oral and written, by child survivors, and that they are no doubt different from the testimonies of the grown-up. Their testimony is closer to literature. Their recollections are tiny, and when they come to recall what happened to them during the war, they mobilize fantasy, sensations, and feelings to reconstruct a bit of their past. This kind of testimony should not be seen as factual testimony, but rather a reconstructed testimony. During the war, I did not see many children. Instinctively, I understood that I should be on my own. But after the war, I met a lot of children. They were part of the masses of survivors wandering on the beaches of Yugoslavia and Italy. The war years in the forests and monasteries had molded their faces and expressions. Some of them sang well. I say well, even so their voices were generally cracked. Their songs were the remnants of melodies from their Jewish homes mixed with scraps of monastery organs. It all came together in them in a new kind of melody that only children in their blindness could create. You could call it innocent or just inelegant. They stood on crates and sang. At the end of the performance, they would pass their heads and ask for payment. Violent managers quickly took them under their protection and they would drag them from camp to camp. There were also girls. I remember one of them well. Her name was Emilia. She was about 10 and she would perform every night. Her repertoire was a mixture of Yiddish songs and forest noises. Her thin, bird-like body always seems as if it were about to fly away. There were child acrobats who walked tightropes with marvelous skill. In the woods, they had learned how to climb highest, thinnest branches. Among them was a set of twins, boys of about 10, who juggled wooden balls. There were also child mimics who would intimate imitate animals and birds. Dozens of children like them wandered around the camp, while the adults tried to forget what had happened and to forget themselves, to get back into the fabric of life. The children molded and refined their suffering as perhaps can be done only in a folk song. I have discussed the fate of the children because it was from them in the course of time that artistic expression arose. It is strange to say so, but one must say so. There was a need for some kind of immediate relation, simple and straightforward, to those horrible events in order to speak about them in artistic terms. Neither sublimation nor apologetics, and not glorification, but rather the way a person speaks about the events of his life, as terrible as they may be, but still in all life. That way of speaking, if one may say so, was the children's. That is the way they expressed themselves when they were in the ghetto and afterwards in the liberated camps. And something of that unmediated quality remained within them even after they grew up and saw themselves as human beings and Jews. Over the years, the problem, and not only the artistic problem, has been to remove the Holocaust from its enormous inhumane dimensions and to bring it close to human beings. By its nature, when it comes to describing reality, art always demands certain intensification, some exaggeration. However, this is not the case with the Holocaust. Everything in it already seems so thoroughly unreal as if it no longer belongs to the experience of our generation, but to mythology. Then comes the need to bring it down to human realm. That is not a mechanical problem, but an essential one. When I say to bring it down, I do not mean to simplify, to attenuate, or to sweet the horror, but to attempt to make the event speak through the individual and in his language, to rescue the suffering from huge numbers, from dreadful anonymity, and to restore the person given and family name, to give the tortured person back his human form, which was snatched away from him. Child survivors cannot recollect the Holocaust the way adult survivors do. Their contribution is bound to their experience. But their limited experience is a profound one. No wonder that from them began Holocaust literature. Thank you very much.
Israeli author Aaron Appelfeld speaking at the renaming ceremony of the Center for Judaic Studies, named for Elie Wiesel. Professor Wiesel responded to Mr. Appelfeld's lecture. He used the occasion to explain why he is allowing his name to be attached to the center and what his hopes are for its future. University professor and Nobel Peace Prize honoree Elie Wiesel.
All of us know that writing means a tone. As you have heard, Aaron Appelfeld's tone, which reflects his talent, his very great measure of inspiration and, above all, his sensitivity. It was a litany. You had a feeling it was a litany, that you were reading a medieval litany after a pogrom or after the Crusades before that. In other words, he has inserted himself in a tradition of responding to suffering, a tradition of trying to elicit a meaning, if not a transcendental possibility of that suffering. What he said is true, but he will tell you, I'm sure, that the opposite can be true as well. For we deal with an event, with a tragedy, whose components are so manifold that whatever I would say about anything could be immediately not contradicted, but added, completed by something else. What Aaron Appelfeld said about the survivors, the child survivors, is profoundly moving, because it's true. However, there were others who would say about other child survivors something else. It was not something which is contrary to what he said, but in addition. What do I mean by that? I have seen child survivors during the war and after the war. Some correspond totally to your image. Others don't. I have seen children who became old men or women and they were still 12 or 13. And they already had a memory as old as the memory of their grandparents. And they could speak with such an authority of experience, of life and death and human destiny and human nature, as if they had already lived 70 years, which was David's age, King David's. There is something about that literature of which Aaron Appelfeld is one of the masters that allows us to speak quietly in whispers. And then it's up to the listener or to the reader to decide whether that whisper contains a shout, a tear, or an appeal to silence. That too is part of that literature. I will come back maybe to that, but first I would like now to say something about, after all, the event which is ours. Aaron Appelfeld has come to honor the event with his very beautiful address. But what do I feel about it? Not about the address, but about the event. Now, you have learned that I've been here for the 26 years or so. And in truth, when Chancellor Silber years ago began talking about naming the center for me, I said no. And it's difficult to say no to Chancellor Silber. I said no because I said, look, I want my name to be on books. And it's enough, my books. And if I can do that, it's enough. But one cannot say no to Chancellor Silber. Finally, I said yes. Now, I have had a life of learning in this place, of sharing with friends. And therefore, what comes to mind is the prayer, the beautiful prayer that we say, the Dayenu. Surely some students of mine have heard that once a teacher of mine said, what is the opposite in philosophy to the absurdity, to the existential absurdity, or to nihilism? And I didn't know the answer, but he said, it is Dayenu. If I had come to Boston University just to meet my very good students, Diana, it's enough. If I had come to Boston University just to meet my very distinguished and kind and learned colleagues, Diana, if I had come to meet my colleagues and not befriended Chancellor Silber, it's again Diana, but I had come to meet my students and my teachers and my colleagues. So, of course, Allah had come over Hama, as we say. So, it's certainly it's a great moment for me. What would I want this center to be? For what it is? Professor Steve Katz, with his dynamism, with his knowledge, with his erudition, with his humanity, is doing wonders, has already done wonders, and he will continue to do so. Surely some of you remember my favorite appeal in the Talmud is during the Hadrian period, when knowledge was a rarity, when it was forbidden to teach, to study, and the penalty of death, a voice was heard in Usha. Whoever learned should come and teach. Whoever hasn't learned should come and learn. I think that should be kind of the frontispiece of this center. Everybody should come and learn. Jews and non-Jews, young and old. Furthermore, even those who learn should come and learn. There's always something to learn here. And then, what do you do with learning? How do you learn? And I believe in learning with a smile. Without arrogance and surely without any trace of humiliation. I am proud of my students because never in my presence has any student felt humiliated. Never. This is, I think, what this center should be. It should give a sense of enrichment, of dignity to each other and create a community of scholarship, which is its own reward. The other marvelous frontispiece, saying on the frontispiece, what I would invoke would be the French one, in the Palais Chaillot. Palais Chaillot in Paris, Paul Valéry, the poet, was asked to write the words, and he was very poor, so they gave him lots of money for every word, and he could have written a novel on that field, but he was a good poet, so he kept it quiet, very short. And it goes more or less like this. He said, il dépend de toi, passant. It depends on you, passerby. Que je sois tombe ou trésor, that I be a tomb or a treasure. Que je parle ou que je me taise, that I should speak or keep quiet. And goes on a few more lines, and then he says, ami, n'entre pas ici sans désir. Don't enter this place without desire. Well, that's, I would like to think that of our center. People should come in with a desire, with fervor, to learn more. And then, there are so many topics that this center will teach and share. Talmud and Bible, Israel and Jewish philosophy, and Jewish literature and Jewish poetry, and whatever has to do with Judaism. And I believe that one must approach a tradition with exaltation. I must approach it at the most noble level, rather than look for the downgrading elements. Find what is noble in that tradition, and we have enough noble moments that we can explore. And then, of course, as Chancellor Silber said about the darkest of our periods, and there when you will study literature and history and poetry and philosophy, all of that is in Aaron Appelfeld's novels. Not only essays, but novels, D.D. Again, the tone, which is always under said, The meaning is so much richer than the vessel. And you go from word to word, and you hear the melody, the quiet melody, giving you another image and another child and another word that we shall learn. We shall learn how to read, how to remember, and how to share. So that should be the center, and therefore, really, always words of gratitude to, naturally, to Steve, Professor Katz, to Leslie Epstein, who is teaching literature with great, great fervor, inspiring fervor in his students. Provost Berkey, the new Dean Henderson, all of my colleagues here, there are many, and my students here, future and past, and my friend, Chancellor John Silber, without whom I wouldn't be here. But now we are both here. Thank you.
University Professor Elie Wiesel on the occasion of the renaming of the Boston University Center for Judaic Studies in his honor. The other dedication from which we'll hear excerpts tonight concerned the Student Village and the Tennyson Sports Center, the first phase of which is completed. The Student Village was named for the John Hancock Corporation, whose $20 million naming gift represents the largest gift of its kind in the university's history. The arena was named for the school's most famous athlete, Harry Aganis, an All-American quarterback who later starred for the Boston Red Sox, before his untimely death in 1955. At the dedication, Chancellor Silber paid tribute to those whose work and vision made the project real. Among them, President Emeritus John Westling. Following Chancellor Silber's remarks, we'll hear from President Emeritus Westling speaking on the ideal of the university and its role in educating the whole person. First, Chancellor Silber.
I'm very pleased to have a part in this great celebration of this completion of this wonderful facility, this Tennyson Track Center, and also for the inauguration of the Student Village and the Harry Aganis Arena. I want to also thank, among the other people who are being thanked this afternoon, whom I'd also like to join in thanking, the Boston University Community Task Force. Many of you are here, and this collection of men and women in the neighborhood have been of enormous support to Boston University in developing the support necessary to get the permits to bring down the old armory and to use this wonderful site for a higher and better use. And I want to again express my appreciation to each and every member of the Boston University Community Task Force. And it's also always a delight to see so many Greeks together at the same time. I haven't seen so many Greeks since I ran for governor, and I must say it was a great joy to me to have the support of the Greek community. Unfortunately, you only voted once, and so I was a little short, but it was great to have your support, and it's great to see so many old friends back here today. Harry Aganis's statue, I hope that all of you will take a look at that. Boston University does not own that statue, although we have possession of it at the moment, and it may take some doing for the owners to get it back. We are very proud to have it on our campus, and we think it would just look great in the foyer of that arena. I want to lay that on the... I want to lay that on the owners and ask if it wouldn't be a great idea to have it there where so many people would see it on so many different occasions. It is wonderfully generous of the John Hancock, having made this sponsorship of the Student Village, to leave to Boston University the opportunity of dedicating the arena to the name and memory of Harry Agganis, who symbolized so much that we believe is important in athletics and why we believe it's important for students. But today, I think also, it's a day to celebrate the vision and determination of John Wessling. I had a big hand in the transformation of Boston University, and I'm in no way modest about it. On the other hand, it would not be honest on my part to try to claim credit for the Student Village. It was a conception of my successor, John Wessling. This is the legacy of John Wessling to Boston University, and it will be a major legacy throughout the future history of this institution.
Universities, despite the inclinations of some who work in them, if they are to succeed at educating each new generation of young men and women, cannot devote themselves solely to the cultivation of the intellect. Indeed, in some ways, that is the easiest of the responsibilities we assume when we undertake the job of education, or at least it's the one we're most confident that we know how to do. But true education is more than a matter of filling a student's mind with the most or even the most sophisticated knowledge we can transmit. It is more even than equipping our students with the tools of logic and analysis that will enable them effectively to manipulate the knowledge that they acquire. This is a hard saying for many in academic life, yet its truth and its importance are apparent to anyone who reads the headlines. One need only look, for example, at the biographies of those corporate and professional leaders who, by greed and short-sightedness, have managed to shake the confidence of the American public in the integrity of market capitalism. In so doing, they've also, in a nice turn of irony, paved the way for just the sort of intrusive regulation that they spent their careers inveighing against. Now, these men are not dropouts. They are not ignorant of the most sophisticated financial, legal, and accounting tools. In fact, they are the possessors of degrees from some of this country's most highly regarded undergraduate and graduate programs. And one doesn't need to focus on just the most extreme examples to recognize that there's something wrong. Just think of the abuse of language to which we're daily treated from those in the highest levels of business and government. We've created a generation of leaders who prate about vision, but whose most distant prospect is next quarter's earnings or the next election, and who believe that complex human institutions can be defined by a woozy and generic mission statement. It's one of Boston University's most important qualities that it's refused to accept the conventional wisdom that education means merely an adequate grounding in the techniques necessary to find an entry-level job. And while we make no claims that we have solved the besetting problems of American higher education, we have taken the first giant step. We've recognized that these problems exist, and we've made finding solutions central to our work. The Student Village is an important symbol of that commitment. It underscores that the fully human life is multifaceted and that, as Plato and Aristotle and Harry Agganis knew, the soul and the body, as well as the intellect, must be cultivated if we are to achieve our full potential. That this commitment has elicited the sponsorship of one of Boston's and the world's great corporations is an occasion both for gratitude and for pride. So is the support we've received and continue to receive from our alumni, friends of the university, and the broader community. And these are among the reasons that while we today celebrate the dedication of this magnificent new building, we are also celebrating the certainty of a great future for a great university. Thanks for being here.
President Emeritus John Westling, speaking at the dedication of the John Hancock Student Village and the Harry Aganis Arena. Earlier, we heard from writer Aaron Appelfeld and Elie Wiesel on the occasion of the naming of the Elie Wiesel Center for Judaic Studies. For a cassette of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes are $15 and include shipping and handling. To learn more about Boston University's World of Ideas, visit our website at buwi.org. Tonight's program was produced by Andy Farnsworth, with help from John Hoder, Michael Garth, and Keith Infantino. Our web producer is Angel Cazelli. I'm Ted O'Brien. Thanks for joining us.
I'm Jackie Lydon. Join me this spring on the next Citizens of the World Tour to Vietnam and Cambodia. Together, we'll see the fine, pale sands of China Beach, travel into the marble mountains where giant statues still stand guard over the ancient caves, and much more, all while helping to pay for the news.
For more information, call 800-909-9287. That's 800-909-9287.